Okay, so I am driving in my car to interview somebody for a podcast. And as I'm driving, I'm thinking about what approach I want to take, you know, how I want to start, how I want to finish and all that. And then I realized that actually what I'm going to try and do today is talk to someone about the Holocaust like it actually happened. I've got to try and put aside everything I think I know, because I've seen a million movies about it and read a million books about it, and because the Holocaust has become this like sort of pop culture reference for us now. It's like there's no surprises left. There's nothing stunning about it anymore. Nothing incredible about it anymore. And it's like it's unreal. Like it never really happened. It's hard to connect to it. I've got to remember that the person I'm about to speak to didn't know about it before it happened to them. They didn't see it coming. They didn't know it was possible because they hadn't seen 100 movies about it like I have. The things that happened to this guy weren't even invented before they were done to him. So I'm going to ask you to listen in the same way, please, to listen to this story as though you don't know how it ends, as though it's the first time you've heard it, and really try and put yourself in his shoes. Really try and think about your family, your parents, your grandmother, your friends, your school, your life, and all of these things happening to you, and about you seeing these things happen to other people. And you know what? I'm not going to beat around the bush about this. Think about your government's policies regarding refugees. And think about the policies of the governments around the world in the 30s with regard to Jewish refugees. And how many Jews died because they couldn't escape. They couldn't get out because no one would take them. Are the millions of refugees around the world today that different? And if they are, why? I mean, how do you justify that? So I'm about to go inside now to the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Elsternwick in Melbourne. I'm going to talk to a man called Willie, who was a Polish teenager in the late 30s, just around about the time that Hitler became Chancellor of Germany and then went on to march into Poland. I'm Michelle Laurie, and this is the Nitty Gritty Committee, conversations about the guts and the glory of life. Brought to you by Car City Ringwood, the largest used car complex in the Southern Hemisphere, carcity.com.au.
Well, I was born in the city of Krakow, which used to be the capital of Poland, and until the about 17th or 18th century, where it was transferred to Warsaw. And my childhood till about 1929 was very good. We had a beautiful apartment, two rooms and a kitchen, which was really rich those days. And in 1929, it's worldwide depression. So I was just a kid, a few years old. My parents lost that apartment. We had to move in to one room. My parents started a business. They rented a little shop, and they were kind of a coffee lounge. And then we moved out from that little room because it became inviting above the shop, a small apartment with two rooms. We didn't need a kitchen because we had downstairs the kitchen. And of course I went to school, and until, you know, the war started, and the things were reasonably good. In 1935, one of the head of, in Poland, Marshal Pilsudski, passed away. He was one of the heroes of liberating Poland from before the World War I. And times have changed. Anti-Semitism started to grow. There were some shops who put a sign up, Jews are not wanted here to come to buy there. There was a group which was called Endecia, you know, and they march and they screamed against Jews, especially around Christmas time. And during the year also, the universities, they started to complain that there should be a smaller percentage of Jewish people at the university. Krakow had a famous university, still there, the Jagiellon University, which was established, I think, in the 15th or 14th century. And that's how you felt around. I was doing not too bad myself. I had a few Polish friends, but you could feel it. Because you could hear it in many places, you know, that say, oh, you're bloody Jew, somebody screaming. You know, when you passed the church and you wear a cap, you had to take the cap off. It doesn't happen all the time, but from time to time there was somebody, and if a Jewish person was wearing a cap, they came in and threw the cap off them.
What about when the Germans annexed Poland? Yeah. When did you know after that that the new regime was going to step it up?
Well, we didn't believe what happened. I mean, it never crossed my mind, not even my parents. We were persecuted, we were restricted. We couldn't walk some streets. Then later on they started to open in ghettos and put the people into the ghettos. And when they were, for instance, in Krakow, there were population about 60,000 or 65,000 Jewish people. And when they opened the ghetto, there was room only between 10 and 15,000. The rest were ordered to move to the east, to the part where, close to the Russian border. When the Germans came in, they shot quite a few people, and non-Jewish as well, you know, and that's how it started.
They just started shooting people. So Poland, and up until that point, is a civilized European nation. There is anti-Semitism that is to the extent of saying Jews are not allowed in this shop or yelling abuse at you in the street. But when the Germans arrive, they start shooting people in the streets.
Yeah, they start shooting them, a lot of them in their small villages, you know, small townships. They could come, shoot a few Jews and move on. You know, later on they did it in the thousands. They used to bring him to forests, dug ditches, big ditches, long ditches, and made people undress and machine gun them, and they falling one on top of the other. And that started to be horrible.
Yeah,
I was a teenager and I had to go to work because I didn't have any trade. So I was doing all the labor's work, cleaning streets, carting furniture, carting some coal, you know, all sort of labor work, and many times beaten up, never got paid for it, never received nothing. When they opened the ghetto, we didn't have a permit to get into the ghetto, but I had a grandmother who was living 30 kilometers south from Krakow, towards the Czechoslovakian border near the Carpathian Mountains. And my father obtained a permit that we can go to my grandmother's. So we went there, and from there I was taken to first was so-called forced labor camp, but then I didn't have any, practically no connection with my family. My family was taken away to an extermination camp in Belzec, in 1942, on the 30th or 31st of August, in 1942, and I was taken to a camp, also in 1942, by the month of May, so about 4 months earlier. Only after the war, I found out what happened to them. Already when I was in Germany after liberation, and when I came to Australia, I found a little bit more about it. That they brought to Belzec, and they were murdered the same day they arrived there in those gas chambers. Till I came to Auschwitz in 1944, I didn't even believe that people are being murdered by gassing in the millions, in the hundreds of thousands. No, I didn't know that.
Was that a rumor? Had you heard a rumor about that, or you knew nothing about that?
There was a little bit of rumor because before I got to Auschwitz-Birkenau, I was working, I was put on to work in the steelworks, and then they brought pots and pans which were melted into the iron ore. I don't know how they did it, but that's what they used it for. And they told me, oh, this came from Belzec, this came from Treblinka, from other camp. So there were rumors about it, and we worked with people, with professionals who worked in the factory there. And there were three people, so they went home. And they brought some news, but they weren't sure of it either. Who could believe that you built a gas chamber to kill people in the hundreds of thousands? I mean, it was hard to believe, you know, especially Germans who are such a well-educated group.
Civilized people.
Yeah, civilized people. Mm. And they didn't look like it. They didn't look like it, no.
So people, when they were given the news that they were to be transported to the east or whatever the euphemism was that they were told, they packed up cookware oftentimes because thought when they arrived they needed to be able to cook food.
Yeah, absolutely. They were told they're going to work on farms or in the factories, whatever. They didn't know that they're going to a death camp, that they were murdered where they arrived. They were just squeezed in into a wagon, 70, 80, 90 people, sometimes 100 people in one wagon. There was standing room only. They traveled for quite a number of hours. And when they came out, and there was a speech who came to a neighbor, blah, 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 and they were taken to the gas chambers.
Well, let's talk about your story specifically. So when you were moved to Auschwitz, was that the first camp that you lived in?
No. My first camp was in Krakow, Plaszów, mm-hmm. and that was known as a forced labor camp. Mm-hmm. There I spent 1 year.
Now, this is the camp, I believe, made famous in Schindler's List.
Right.
And the character Eamon Gert, who was played by Ralph Fiennes, who famously, in the movie at least, was a sadist who would enjoy standing on his balcony with a gun and shooting Jews who were walking around doing their work in the camp and stuff like that. That's where you were.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
That was the camp. It was Eamon Gert. He was a vicious, vicious, inhuman sadist. There were many incidents I could talk about, but the one which sticks still in my head is one day he was riding a horse, and suddenly I heard a shot, and I saw somebody fall over. I couldn't tell you if it was a man or a woman, because he didn't discriminate against women. He wasn't a sexist. You know, he punished women the same like men. He had women flogged, he had women whatever, you know, and the same like men. And, you know, I met up with him after the war. Mm-hmm. He was arrested by the Americans. And my English has improved very much because I learned English in school before the war, but during the war I forgot every word of it. But being between the Americans, I started to recover, and then one American officer became my friend, mm-hmm. and he became my mentor. So if I said something wrong in English, he corrected me, which helped a great lot. And I was working for a while, for over a year, year and a half, for the Americans at the main gate at the Dachau camp, which became also a prison for the SS, were imprisoned there.
After the war, they ended up using, the Allies ended up using Dachau camp as a prison for German prisoners of war.
And also there was a war crimes tribunal in the Dachau, and they had a lot of criminals, because there was what they called a bunker, and that was like a solitary confinement. And one day, an American general came in, and I got a call to the main gate to come to see the commandant's office and the American. And he introduced me to the general and a few officers, and he said to me, would you take the general and the officers around the camp, show him around? We went to the camp inside, and of course, once we went to a barrack, everybody jumped up, all the Germans there, and one of the, he was a felt a sergeant or something, and he melted that. And I remember I was laughing. The general said to him, "You report to him, to me." Mm. You know, it was something unbelievable. The pleasure what I had that I stay and he is on attention. Yeah. And then I could never get to that bunker to get in there because nobody could go in there, only the Americans, you know. There. So I said to the general, "General, would you like to see the bunker?" Because that's what the Germans had. And he said, "Oh, yes, what's there?" I said, "They are the criminals there, the real criminals." He said, "Okay, let's go." When we came to the gate, of course, a general comes, everybody stands to attention. And the general said, "I would like to go inside, have a look." And he said straight away, he rang up, the officer of the guard came. "Yes, sir." And so I went with him. And there were, you know, doors like in a prison. And the little things. And suddenly on that, I see Amundgett, and I started to shake. And I said to the general, "General, you think you can give an order that I can go in and see him?" And I told him on the way about, like I talk to you now, about my experiences, and I mentioned the name Amundgett also, because that was my first camp. And he had a look at me, and he said, "Yeah, I can do that, but I want you to think of something, what I'm going to tell you. And then when you decide you want to go in, I will give the order. If you go in there and do what I think you want to do, you will become like him." Mm. Now, is that what you want? You know, that really, you know, hit me. I got stumped. I didn't know what to answer because I started to realize that he's right. I become a criminal like him. I wanted to go in to hit him, spit on him, you know? And I said, "General, thank you very much, what you just told me. I don't want to go in. You are absolutely right. That's a good lesson for me for my life." And he was very happy that I told him there. And off he went. And about 10 days later, came two officers from Poland, here too, and they took him to Poland, to Krakow, where he was tried. He had three defense lawyers. He had the right to question the witnesses, everything, but he was sentenced to death and they hung him in Poland in 1946. Mm. You know? Mm. I would rather see that he rots in prison instead of being hung. Mm. Because hung, okay, so it takes half an hour, you know, the whole procedure, or an hour, and that's it, he's gone. But in prison, if he stays a few years, he suffers a bit. That's what I wanted.
Did you ever take the opportunity to take out some of your anger and pain on German people in that camp or anywhere else? Did you ever spit on them the way they spat at you? Or?
No. Never. Never, never, ever. When Gett was taken away, they had to come to the main gate to pick up the documents, the officers, they had to leave. That was the law. Of course, there was the military police, and I was just doing some interpretations, who came in. So I went to that truck, and I said, "Amon, you go now back to Plaszow," because that was the name of the camp in Krakow. That's an outer suburb of Krakow, where the camp was, on top of a Jewish cemetery. Mm. And then they took some more land to increase it. "Now you go to Poland, and you will be welcomed by the Jews. And to be welcomed, you got 25 on your backside." Because that's what he was doing to a lot of people, men and women, you know? He never said a word. Mm. He was sitting quiet. He was a big fellow, you know, much taller than me. Nice. Big fellow. That was the only thing which I spoke. And I live in Germany, between Germans, and I got on with him quite all right, I never got out, you know, to be angry or speak that. There's nothing I could do. What could I do? I took that, what the general told me, I took it really in mind. Mm-hmm. You know, today people ask me, do you hate the Germans? And you know what my answer is? No. No. Because the perpetrators, I can't forgive them, and I can't forget them. But the children, they're not guilty. What could they do? Maybe if they grew up, they would become like their father or their mother, because there were women in DSS who were also very cruel, you know, and that's how it was.
Now, in speaking of women who were brutal, Buchenwald had a commandant, Otto Koch, and his wife was Isa Koch.
She was in Dachau.
She was in Dachau as well, at the end there, when you were there, when the German prisoners were there. Can you explain her significance, and did you meet her there?
I saw her when I went to that bunker. She was one of those cells, but I didn't speak to her. I didn't know at the time how bad she was. What she did is, when she got prisoners and she saw they got a nice tattoo.
Like me?
Yeah, you probably...
Tattoos,
yes,
like me.
Absolutely. You would be on her list. She had him killed and take the skin off with the tattoo, and she made lampshades out of it. And those lampshades, I am told, can be seen today in Sachsenhausen. That's in Oranienburg near Berlin. There was a concentration camp there before the war. They started that.
I worry sometimes that there are so many movies. There's so much popular culture about the Holocaust, movies, books. I'm 42 years old, so I've grown up and I feel like I've seen everything, that it desensitizes people to the reality of what happened to you. It's like a cliched pop culture reference now. How do you feel about that?
Well, the movies are good in a way. I don't know. You know, it's very hard to say whether, for instance, just before you came, I had here students. I know there were about 50 of them, maybe 40. I don't know, I didn't count them. And I have, every time I come here, I speak to students. Those 2 days, like I mentioned to you. Now, there are some students who are very interested. I am not a teacher, but when I stand in front and I see them, I could see which one is interested, which one is not. There are some who try to sleep, others at the back, sits next to a girl and they romance with each other. You know, they're not interested, then they started to laugh. Sometimes I get annoyed, you know, because when I speak, I want everybody to understand and to believe me that I'm, in another 10, 15 years, there will be none of us. Mm-hmm. None of the survivors will be. I can tell you, even the child survivors. You know, it's 70 years now. Mm-hmm. So how long can we live? And, it was a few weeks back, there was a couple. They were telling jokes apparently to each other, and they were laughing, tried to make it quietly. And I saw him. From the beginning, I kept quiet. I kept on going and going. And then I got a little bit annoyed. You know, if they didn't listen to me, it's okay. But to laugh and to disrupt some others. So I asked them if they could tell me the joke they were talking about, because I would like to have a laugh too. Mm. And the teacher straight away had a look at him. And they kept quiet till the end of the story. Well, I don't do that very often. Usually when I see doesn't listen. I'm not going to force myself on anybody. And after I finish, some people ask questions. They want to know more about it, about how I feel about that, and that. You know, and so I give the answer to the best of my knowledge. And if they ask me a question and I don't know, I said, I'm very sorry, I don't know. Mm. I can't answer that. Because I don't like to discuss religion, politics, because I'm not good in religion, so good, you know, to know every answer. No. So they have to go to a priest or to a rabbi. They should know that. And politics, I'm not a politician, I'm a too honest man, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know politics. So I don't want to get into it.
I suppose because I was raised by, my mum is kind of obsessed with the Holocaust, to be honest. And And so I have a very fertile imagination, and so I imagine myself, try and imagine myself in your situation, and I look at you and I think, God, you survived Auschwitz. You have tattoo on your arm of the number. I just can't imagine anyone sitting in front of you when you're talking and laughing and not understanding or not putting themselves in your shoes. Can you believe that happens?
You know, when I came, that was the first time, when I came to Birkenau, to Auschwitz in 1944, and I told you I'm an apprentice bricklayer, so one day we were taken to the women's compound to do some brickwork. And suddenly I have a look, and they brought some woman from a barrack, and the order came out, close off. When I heard it in German, when I heard it, I had a look, and the woman, all naked. Mm. I have never seen a live naked woman in my life, never. Mm. So I said, oh my God. So I looked for a while, and then I saw so many. I said, it's enough. Didn't want to look. So I'm thinking, you know, because before the war, there were no bikinis, you see. Today, the women are not as shy as they used to be. A woman, if she needed to fix up her stocking, she went somewhere in a corner, nobody sees, to fix up a little frock up till here and to fix the stocking. You know, there were one-piece swimsuits. And of course, we live near the Vistula River, not near a sea. Mm-hmm. So people went and bathed and swam in the river. And they were very, you know, very shy. Mm-hmm. And today you go to the beach, they are topless and that, you know. And that shook me because I was brought up in that situation that you respect women. Mm-hmm. I remember when it was raining, tram, and I was just a boy, 12 years old, and a woman was a young woman, could be 15 years old. I stood aside from her, let her get in into the tram first. I got wet, and then I went. When I was sitting in the tram, and there were all seats taken, and suddenly a woman came in, I always used to get up. She didn't have to be an old one.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years old, 25, I got up, please sit down. Yeah. And I stood. Today that doesn't exist.
No.
You can see young boys or young girls sitting, and comes even an old woman, and they wouldn't give her the space. They wouldn't get up, please sit down. Mm. Very, very, very rarely it happened. Now I don't, for the past quite a number of years, I got a car, so I don't use the public transport. Mm. So I don't know how it's happening now, but I don't think so.
But do you think that young people now who, with the internet, can see, they can see beheadings from battles?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they can see terrible war crimes in colour that people have filmed on their phones.
Yeah.
Are they desensitized to stories like yours because of that?
I tell you what, that it shocks me. You know, I saw on TV they were beheading some people. I think it was somewhere in Syria or in Iraq. They were beheading. They didn't show how they're beheading, but what they show is the fellow with the knife and the one on the knees, and then they chopped the head off. Mm. And I think that there was a young boy who was holding a head by the hair, just the head. But that was just the flesh. They didn't show it for long. And that really shook me up.
Yeah. You must have thought that you had seen the worst things you were ever going to see by the end of 1945.
That almost repeat itself.
Yeah.
It's not exactly as that, because people are fighting, you know, with each other, and one kills each other. But there, we didn't kill, we didn't fight.
Yeah.
Although there was a resistance, there was definitely a resistance. There were many partisans in the thing. I wasn't lucky. I had two good friends you know, with whom I was in the camp, and they escaped from the camp, and they went to the with the partisans, and I met one of them after the war.
Wow.
They survived the war. I met him in Germany, and I said, how could you do that to me? You went away, didn't take me with you.
Mm.
He said, look, I had military experience. I was in the army before the war, and you didn't.
Mm.
And the times were pretty tough, and you had to hide and that. But you survived, so what are you complaining about?
Yeah. Let's talk about how tough things got and what you're reduced to as a human being and things that you never thought you would do. I've read about you that you went to the hospital with something in the camp, and when you came back, all of your things were stolen. Your clothes, the tiny possessions that you had were gone.
That was when I was in Plaszów. What was the illness? My head's getting... there was an epidemic, and I thought I had high fever. So they took me from my barrack, and one barrack was like a hospital. There were bunks, and on every bunk there were two people.
Mm.
And the bunks were just narrow. It was just about 3 feet or 1 meter wide, the bunks. Head to toe, we lived. And I was there, and I was very lucky that we had no medication whatsoever. And the fever dropped. I was there about 2 weeks or so. And after 2 days without fever, they sent me back to the barrack, and they gave me 1 week off.
Mm.
Now a rumor started to fly around the camp that all the people who are here, who are sick, semi-sick, will be shot.
Mm.
And they were shooting people there. Because one day they brought 22 people, which they've been accused that they are unfit of work, to work, and they put them behind our barrack, and he shot them there.
Mm.
It was, he was, I think, a rank of a staff sergeant or something. He done the shooting. His name was Miller, Hans Josef Miller.
Mm.
And he shot them, 22 people, just behind my barrack, so I believed that. And I didn't have any shoes, I just had a pair of pants and a jacket, very light jacket, no shirt. And when I heard it next morning, I went out with the group to work, barefooted, and going on the rough thing, don't ask, it was terrible.
Yeah, because people had stolen the few things that you had,
I suppose.
They thought you were going to die.
Yeah, that was still in the beginning, that was in 1942. And then I obtained a pair of shoes which didn't quite fit, so I cut the heel at the back, and I didn't have any string, anything to tie up, so I found some wire and tied up.
Now, where did you obtain the shoes from? Do you remember?
Yeah, from the warehouse. You could queue up there because, you know, some people came with clothes, you know.
Mm.
And they took it all away. And I went there, and there was the only pair of shoes which fitted, but it was too short. And I put it, I remember some wire I found there, and it cut in my ear and started to bleed. So then I found pieces of cardboard and put it under the wire, so that my heels were safe. And I was working like that. And later on, I went once again to the warehouse to get a pair of shoes, because I showed them, you know, the wounds on that. So I found a good pair of shoes with wooden soles, timber, you know. And later on in another camp, I got a pair of shoes that were called Dutch shoes, Hollanderki, and they were all from wood.
Oh, the clogs?
Cogs,
yeah,
all from. Yeah. And I tell you what, I was very lucky because we were carting rail lines, you know, single ones, and suddenly one slipped and fell over on my foot. So it broke that cog, and but my foot was saved. Took it off, and it was safe, and I don't know, I tied up to have it together, and I did get another pair of shoes, I think.
Did you ever do anything that you're ashamed of in the darkest, deepest, darkest days of survival in a concentration camp?
I don't think so. I didn't have any function whatsoever in the camp, you know, to supervise.
But even, I mean, you know, pinching a bit of bread from somebody else, or just...
No, that was a crime. If you got caught, they beaten you up, the other prisoners. Even the capos would beat you up for it. Because you got your ration, and somebody else got his ration. You eat his ration, you make him die, you know. I never done that.
Mm. I've heard stories, though, of people dying in the bunks and the other prisoners not telling the guards so that they could keep that extra ration for a few days.
Yes, that did happen. That did happen. I remember when I was taken, I was already very, very weak. From the sub camp of Dachau to Dachau, that was in April 45, and on that wagon we were about 70 people or so about, and by the time we got to Dachau, which took us a day and a half and wasn't that far, probably 80, 90 kilometers away, and when we landed there, nearly half of that wagon were dead. They died from starvation. And when they came, how many of you? 70. And those who were alive had the bread from the dead people.
Yeah.
At that time, when I came to Birkenau, in Auschwitz, the life was better than it was in Birkenau. Those people, most of them had jobs. They had, of course, there was, I think, block number 10 or 11 where they done the interrogation, because mostly there were political people there, Romas, communists, Poles, Catholics, the French, Belgium, some Germans, you know, they were mostly in Auschwitz. There were practically no Jews there. Usually they put all the Jews to Birkenau. There were a few Jews there. We got even here one guide who works on Fridays, and he was in Auschwitz, but he was a German Jew. He was from Germany, and they arrested him. They sent him to Auschwitz. He was there nearly 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. He got some good jobs and that, you know. Some Germans were arrested there, you know, but they all have some good positions.
Mm-hmm. Was Birkenau kind of attached to Auschwitz? Were they next to each other?
Three kilometers away.
Yeah. So I think we think of all of that as the Auschwitz camp.
Yeah, Birkenau was known also as Auschwitz II.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was Auschwitz II, but that was the extermination part. They were murdered in Auschwitz itself, many people. Mm. By starvation, hanging, shooting. They had a black wall there where they were shooting people, like in block, I think it was block 11 or 10, I don't remember, where they interrogated people. There were some priests. There were many, many stories about Auschwitz.
In my imagination, it's depraved, and I don't understand how you could keep your sanity and your humanity at all in that situation.
Well, that was determination, and you had to believe in survival. Mm. Once you lost the belief and you didn't believe they would survive, you didn't. My luck was that I was till the last minute, I believed. The last thing was when they took some group people of the known death march. I was very, very sick, very weak. My weight was about 38 kilos, you know, and that was the time when they took a group of people to march, and I wouldn't go on that march. There was lying a tree there, and I sat down on the tree, and I said, if they have to shoot me here. That was the only time where I was, where I lost faith, that I gave up. That the only time. Mm. But if somebody didn't come to me, I still served. And they put us on the train, roofless boxes, roofless wagons, and they brought us to Dachau.
Okay.
from the
Now, side. You were very sick on that train, weren't you?
Yeah, I was very sick. A very heavy diarrhea, and there was nothing in there. I passed some blood. My heart was weak. My lungs weren't in the work. Everything. And I was very skinny, just skin and bones.
I bet you were pretty unpopular, too, on the train with your stomach troubles. Were people yelling at you and angry with you?
Yeah. That stinks, and I had to throw away my undies. Oh. You know, and then we came to Dachau, and they put till liberation, I was in Dachau itself 2 days. I went down, I was running every half an hour to the lavatory there. I had to throw away my undies and then my pants. All I had is a little jacket and a shirt. And then I was taken to hospital by the Americans. I think we were liberated on the 29th of April, and on the 2nd or 3rd of May, I was in hospital.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, labour the point, but it just, I was thinking about what you were saying before. You grew up in an environment that was very formal and very polite, you know, in which you'd never seen a naked woman before, and to find yourself so dehumanized as to be virtually naked in the world.
Yeah.
It's incredible in the space of 5 years.
No. It didn't matter nothing. No. It didn't bother me. We were naked when we were in Birkenau every week, selection.
Wow.
You know, if somebody didn't look too good, they took his number, and in a day or two they took him away what they called the Himmelstraße, the avenue to heaven.
Oh.
That's what they called to go to the gas chambers, to the crematorias. And I was extremely lucky that I survived all those. So all the men were naked, you didn't bother even, it didn't matter. And I was working about nearly 2 weeks on the women's compound, and every day there were selections for women. Some were sent to other camps, some were sent to crematoria, whatever. I didn't even bother to look. Tell you what, one day we were working, and women were bringing bricks to us from somewhere, from a railway station or whatever. And suddenly somebody calls me by my name. And I look at her, and I couldn't recognize her. And suddenly, what, don't you know me? Oh my God, that's my cousin. And she was about 3 or 4 years older than me, a beautiful girl, always nicely hair done, you know, nicely dressed, and she was a cashier, and that was a high-class job before the war. And she was, and I didn't recognize her, no hair, she was shaved off, because all the people, they came in, women, they shaved them all off, from all over the body, everywhere. You know, so I didn't recognize her. And next day, I said, I didn't have any bread. No, I did have a small piece of bread with me. And I said, well, how, you had some food, you hungry? She said, oh no, I'm so hungry. So I gave him the small piece of bread. I said, have that. And what about you? I said, oh, I'm getting some more. And I gave it to her, she was happy. And I told her, come out to the same job tomorrow. Maybe I'll be able to organize a little bit extra bread. Because I had a friend who was working in a commando known as Canada. What they did is they cleaned up the wagons from the people who came. They were told to leave everything there. And they always had plenty of food because people had bread or some cake or whatever. And he had that. So he shared it with me for a while. He was in the next barrack to me. I was in 28 and he was in 32, I think, two barracks away. And he always helped me out because he had plenty. So I said that I meet him and he probably give me another piece of bread, you know, so I give it to her. But she never came back, so I asked there some women what happened with that. They said they were all sent to another camp, but I never saw her again. She didn't survive.
Question.
Yeah.
When was the first time somebody was kind to you again? So I'm assuming this is to do with your liberation. Yeah, and I guess liberation, like, you know, when you were liberated, when was someone kind to you? What was the first great thing that happened?
When the Americans took me to the hospital, that was the first great thing what happened. Mm. Because when they washed my lice-riddled body with warm water, which I didn't have for the past 4 or 5 months, that was something wonderful. And I couldn't overcome that.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Willie. Have you got a talk again now? Have you got a talk again now to students? You'll find more info about all of our guests at michellelaurie.com, as well as a place to leave questions and feedback. There's also a link there to the website of Tenzin Choyil. He is the man behind the beautiful Tibetan music you've heard throughout the podcast. Thank you to Tim Mountford and Peter Laurie for editing help, but please know that the clunkiest edits are all mine. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Nitty Gritty Committee, conversations about the guts and the glory of life. Please subscribe to get them all on iTunes and go ahead and leave us a nice review if you feel so inclined.